In June of 2012, veteran Ashley Biggs was working delivering food for the takeaway chain Domino's Pizza. One night, she went out to deliver an order and she never returned. The next day, her lifeless body was discovered in her car, and investigators struggled to understand why anyone would want her dead. But of course, things are never quite as they seem. And as opposed to this just being an unlikely robbery gone wrong, it didn't add up. So they started to look at whether anyone in Ashley's life may benefit from her death. And the information they uncovered didn't disappoint. This is the heinous murder of Ashley Biggs. I'm Emma Kenny. Welcome to Bang to Rights, the deep dive crime podcast, which takes you through some of the most heinous crimes the world has ever seen. So let's talk about our victim, Ashley Biggs. She's born on January the 9th, 1987. She grew up in a nice family. She was somebody who got on very well with her peers. In 2003, she meets 21-year-old Chad Cobb. This is when she was out roller skating. He'd basically been in the military, but then he began working in telecommunications. He'd served for 6 months at that point. Now, it seems that a friendship initially develops, but then that turns into an intimate relationship. So Ashley was 17 when she met him, and then a year later, she gives birth to their daughter. That's a big deal, isn't it? I mean, you're such a young person at 17, and I know there are lots of people who successfully and happily have children at that age, but I think for the most part, at 17, you're discovering yourself, you've not figured out who you're going to be. There are loads of milestones that you want to achieve, and it must be overwhelming to find yourself in a situation where you've got into a relationship and very quickly got pregnant, as is the case where Ashley is concerned. But they do try to make a go of the relationship, they move in together, but they actually end up breaking up when their daughter is just 1 year old. And I think we can all appreciate how challenging it will be for a young couple who basically meet, get involved, quickly get pregnant, end up having the baby, and then move in with one another. For anybody, that's going to cause stresses and strains. Even if you were a mature couple, that's going to be challenging. Even if economically you're in a good place, it's going to be tough because it's happened so fast. And the truth is, they haven't got those buffers such as age and money on their side. They're kids. Even at 21, you're still a very young person, and life is going to be overwhelming and scary. And it seems that that is the case for them. And Ashley's family have some real concerns about the relationship. They actually said that the relationship she had with Cobb had fractures right after they move in together. Ashley had started to become incredibly distant, and Cobb became very abusive, according to her family. Now, we understand if you are in an abusive relationship, the playbook of the abuser is indeed to make you become distant from your support networks, because the more they can isolate you, the more that they control you. So that certainly is in keeping with what we see in abusive relationships. And Ashley apparently had her family witness bruises on her arms. And at some point down the line, even though this relationship doesn't last too long, Ashley's family actually get involved. They're really concerned. And they're telling her, listen, this is not a good place for you to be. It's not a good space for you to be. We can see that you are experiencing domestic abuse and you need to get out. And Ashley does indeed decide that she's going to leave Chad. And this ultimately happens because he hits her physically while she was holding their daughter. So now she feels that she's not safe, but also potentially the relationship is making her daughter not safe. Now, he did plead guilty to this charge. So this isn't just hearsay from Ashley's family. Clearly, there was a charge against him because of that violence. Now, in 2008, Ashley is looking to up her career and have an opportunity to change her life for the better. So she joins the army. Now, it's not for a very long time, but she actually gives Chad full custody of their daughter. And I guess for some people looking into that, you'd think to yourself, well, if you've got this abusive partner, this abusive ex now, why do you wish to give your child to them full time? Surely that could be deeply problematic because they might be in danger. But essentially, she mustn't think in her mind that he's a threat to the daughter. And what I will note about Chad Cobb throughout this is that he certainly has an incredibly close relationship with Grace's daughter. There is no doubt whatsoever. And so I'm going to envision that she sees the alignment of his emotional reactions to the daughter with his feelings for her, and that she feels safe enough to move on and take a job in the army, knowing that her daughter is going to be safe with him in spite of the issues they have in their relationship. So now he's got full custody. While she was in the army, she served as a 92F, which is a petroleum supply specialist. Now, Ashley doesn't last long in this position. And the reason for that is she's medically discharged. She had asthma. I would say that was something they probably early on should have been noting about her, but maybe it was something that developed after she joined. But at this point, it means that her life has changed, and therefore the focus is not being in the army, it's not being in the services, it's back to being a mother. And she's just absolutely determined that she's going to get full custody of her daughter. Now, whilst she was in the army, which, let's be honest, wasn't a huge amount of time, Chad moves, changes his phone number, and begins dating someone new. That makes no sense whatsoever. And it also speaks to a particular territorial and possessive nature. When it comes down to it, if you've had a child with somebody, they are half of that child's life. You may not like that or appreciate that, but it's reality. And if they are somebody who is a decent human being, and Ashley certainly was a decent human being, there is no reason why you would want that child not to have a mother available to them. The idea that you've not only changed your number, which means they can't contact you, you've literally moved so they don't have your address, and now you're playing happy families with somebody else. That's about you wanting to eradicate and erase the reality that you need to be confronting, not denying. So Ashley is understandably going to be very upset by this, because he is orchestrating and literally creating a scenario where she has no relationship with her daughter. And some people may say, well, she chose to give him full custody. He's got a right to go off and live his own life. Yes, we all agree with that. But not at a detriment to her having some place in her daughter's life. Now, in 2010, Cobb actually marries his girlfriend. So this person that he's took up with and now he's bringing up his daughter with. So this is Erica Stefanko. She was actually called Erica Lyon, obviously, when they met. She didn't have his second name, but throughout this, we're definitely referring to her as Stefanko. Now, Cobb and Stefanko had connected on MySpace. How very retro, guys. The fact that I'm even saying the words MySpace takes me back a considerable amount of time. But they connected in December of 2006, and Ashley and Cobb's daughter Grace lived with her dad, Erica, and three other children. So one of those were Erica's from a previous relationship, and two of the children were who they had together as a couple, and then obviously Grace from Ashley and Cobb's relationship. So in 2012, basically, Ashley's life has moved forward as well. She's in a happy relationship, a stable relationship with a woman named Brittany Dunson. They were living together in Akron, Ohio, and Ashley was doing well. She'd enrolled on a course of physical therapy at Star State College. And at this point, she was allegedly saving money to try to make sure that she had enough for her daughter's college education, which is something that's really positive. And it also says that she is committed to her child. She may not be having as much time as she wishes with her child, but she is certainly going out of her way to make sure that the future for Grace is going to be a positive one. So basically, aside from the studies, she's employed as a janitor at Malone University, and she's also working as a delivery driver for Domino's Pizza in Portage Lakes Plaza. So basically, she's really committed to raising as much cash as possible, and part of that is because she's devoted to her daughter's future. I would say that even though there are all these real positives going on in Ashley's life, it's not positive on the whole, because she's got a huge amount of tension going on, and that tension lies between Ashley and Cobb. So both of them are dealing with a contentious issue regarding the daughter's custody. They are really disagreeing on where she should live and how her life should be. Ashley basically wants full custody, and she's absolutely driven to obtain this. apparently this was so contentious that they were making claims against each other, and these claims were occurring monthly, which just demonstrates the level of feeling involved in this. And when you think about custody full stop, you're talking about a child and your relationship with that child, and you having a particular formula or belief system over what that child should be experiencing. And often a parent will have a complete differing view from the other parent, both parents believing that the view they have is the correct one, leading to a lot of concerns and crises and obstacles and problems that often the family court have to sort out. Also, ideally, when it comes down to custody arrangements, you don't want the courts involved. It's the worst case scenario for courts to be involved. Anybody who's ever been through a custody dispute will tell you that they wish it could have been sorted in a different way, because you have different people with no connection to you making decisions over your experience with your child. It's far better for children to have the parents agree and be kind and co-parent. Yes, your relationship failed. Yes, you have collateral psychologically and emotionally and financially sometimes from that relationship, but hey, you don't matter. The only person that matters is your child. Get it sorted through means where it's positive for both you as co-parents and for your child as the individual dealing with those co-parents. But in this case, that hadn't played out this way. So they are constantly annoyed with one another, and that bitterness and hostility and resentment is clear. And again, that comes from a positive place. We can never deny that. It comes from their feeling that they have towards Grace. But nonetheless, it means that they are constantly stuck in this place, both of them wanting full custody, neither of them necessarily wishing to shift on the points that they want to achieve. And that might not be, in this case, what's best for the little girl. So these claims are going on constantly. Cobb's saying that Ashley had once falsely reported that he'd taken their daughter out of state, and that, in effect, would have gone against their custody agreement. So he'd have breached agreed rules, and that would have been problematic. And some sources also add to this that one of the contentious issues was that Cobb really had a problem with Ashley's lesbian relationship. So potentially he didn't like the lifestyle that she was leading, and that was one of the reasons why he didn't want his daughter around them. But what we do know is, irrespective of how bitter and problematic it was, both parents love their daughter. Now, sadly, one of those parents won't get the chance to continue to love their daughter, at least on this plane, because on June the 20th, 2012, the Domino's Pizza place where Ashley worked, they get a call. It's just before midnight they get this call. Call comes from a woman called Jen. Now, bear in mind, Ashley, who worked at Domino's Pizza, she was really well respected. She was apparently really fast at making sure that all her calls were done. She was always there on time. She was the person that was most trusted by the manager. He said that she was the best driver, hands down. So Ashley then goes to deliver the pizza to that requested address, and the address was the back door of a business on West Turkeyfoot Lake Road. Now, there was nothing particularly unusual about this order. Lots of people order to addresses, lots of people work through the night, so arguably grabbing some food would not stand out as unusual. But what is unusual is after Ashley goes there, she doesn't come back. She doesn't return to the Domino's Pizza place after leaving to make this delivery. Also, the manager said that they knew she should have been back with about 20 to 30 minutes, and the fact that she wasn't really concerned him. So he starts calling her. It's very clear that this particular Domino's manager really has an invested connection with his employees, because he doesn't just leave it. He's not upset that maybe she's clocked off early and let him down. He knows she would never do that. Something is wrong. So he's calling constantly, and he reckons, well, you know what? I know where Ashley was sent to. I know where she was going to deliver. I tracked it, so therefore he could actually go and visit the place that he believed the pizzas were meant to be delivered. So he's calling her as he's doing that, and then he drives literally to the place that she delivered the pizza. And he's horrified, because even though he can't see Ashley, what he can see is blood, and a lot of it. So immediately he calls the police. Now, when the police arrive at the actual address the pizzas have been dropped off at, apparently, first off, they notice that the actual whole area is just pitch black. No one's there. It's not as if people have been working in that area. It seems like it's abandoned to some degree, at least at that time of night. Also, it's obvious to them that Ashley isn't actually physically there, nor is her car. They can't find a car either. But what they can see as they're using their flashlights is signs of a struggle in the car park. So they can see drag marks. They also see the white dots that come when a taser's been used. And again, just as the manager had noticed, there was this large amount of blood there. It doesn't take them long to figure out this can't be some kind of robbery gone wrong. And if it's a kidnapping, if it's an abduction, well, it would have to be well planned. And that wouldn't really make sense because she didn't have anything too notable to steal or to hold for a ransom. So then they start thinking to themselves, well, what else is going on in Ashley's life? And it takes a really short amount of time to realise that there is this big, bitter custody battle between Ashley and her ex-husband, Cobb. So it gets to around 3:30 in the morning. I mean, this is happening really quickly. This is moving really fast. An officer's found out that Cobb drives a black Lincoln Navigator and also only lives about 20 minutes away. Now, when they go and visit to see whether he's home, he isn't. So as they haven't been able to find him at his home address, they then look at where the black Lincoln's registered to, and it turns out it was registered to the home of Chad's grandparents. And his grandparents actually lived just about half a mile from the delivery location. So when the officer arrives at that address, he goes to look at a garage, which is at the back of the house. And as he's looking, he realises that firstly, the car's there and that Stefanko is in the passenger seat of the black car, which is clearly the Lincoln, which was parked behind the garage. Also, there's four children in the back of the car. This is in the early hours of the morning. So this is really unusual. Why would you have four children in the car at this time at your grandparents' house? It doesn't make any sense. Also, the officer heard apparently really heavy footsteps in the nearby woodland. And at this point, he's called for backup. So the police arrive and then they start searching the woods. And it's at this point they literally discover Cobb hiding in the trees. And immediately you think to yourself, well, there could be an explanation as to why they'd gone to his grandparents in the early hours of the morning with the kids. I mean, there could be something. Somebody could be ill. There could have been a leak at home. Something. There could be a reason. But there would be absolutely no reason for somebody who's got nothing to hide to have run into the woods and then have to be discovered because you're hiding in the trees. You have to have some knowledge that they are looking for you for a reason. Otherwise, you would just be like, what are all these police doing here? I've got nothing to hide. I've done nothing wrong. Just carrying on with my own business. The very fact that he's ran off is incriminating enough. Automatically, the police are going to be thinking, we've got our guy. Now, Cobb and Erica Stefanko, they're both placed in the back of the police car. Cobb at this point is asked to talk about his relationship with Ashley and also to say whether he knew what had happened to Ashley. He said, I don't know anything, I can't help you. Apparently he wasn't helpful at all and neither was she. In fact, they basically just asked for a lawyer. Now, Cobb and Stefanko at this point are taken to the police station. Of course they are, because as far as the police are concerned, they are banged to rights. The only people that begin the line of fire for this crime, they're looking at them. But Stefanko is actually later released. So they obviously have enough evidence to hold Cobb for further inquiries, but not necessarily Stefanko. Now, when they get a warrant and they search Cobb and Stefanko's home, well, it doesn't look good. First of all, they found a weapon similar to a taser. They find zip ties. They find camouflage clothing and face paints. They've got a roll of duct tape, which is one of those things that automatically just screams serial killer, isn't it? I mean, no one has just got duct tape to hand on the whole unless they work in a specific field that would use it. With respect, if you've got duct tape and it's just hanging around with a taser, etc., you've got a kill kit. They also have a pair of gloves with hardened knuckles and a flashlight with a red lens, which basically is used to provide night vision. So why would you have all of that? If there is even a shred of potential that you're innocent, none of those things would be found at your home. It's as simple as that. Now, the next day, this is June the 21st, we still haven't found Ashley's body or Ashley if she's alive. All we know is there's a pile of blood. She's missing, and it's seriously pointing towards something terrible having happened to her. And as they're still searching for her, they get a call. So the Wayne County Sheriff's Office picks up the phone, essentially, and a woman is speaking to them about something she's seen that worries her. So she'd seen a red light in a cornfield near her house in the Chippewa Township, and it had been flashing since the morning. And she just said it was untoward. It felt strange, and she wanted it checked out. So the sheriff's deputy is sent out, and he goes to investigate. And at this point, as he's getting closer to the car, he realises it's one that fits the description of Ashley's. And then when he gets closer, he realises, sadly, it's got the same number plate. So now he knows this is Ashley's car. He tentatively goes and looks at the car and through the window. And then as he looks in the car, he makes this awful discovery. The worst case scenario plays out, because on the back seat is the dead body of a woman. He doesn't know it's Ashley, but let's be real, there is one woman missing. They are looking for her. It's her car, and there's a dead body in the back seat. I appreciate there is protocol and people have to identify the actual individual by notable features or by actually the presence of being there and saying, yes, that's my daughter, son, etc. But in this case, it's obvious Ashley has to be the person in the back seat. What is really upsetting, aside from the fact we now know that there is a dead woman, a dead mother, a dead daughter, it's the way she's obviously died, which is harrowing. So her wrists had been zip tied together. Apparently her face was a shade of very dark purple, and there was also a zip tie tightened around her neck. It is incomprehensible to me to imagine the kind of terror you would endure when you realised that your life was being taken in this way, and when you're struggling to find breath. Anybody who's ever had a moment of time where they've hyperventilated or choked a little, you have that instantaneous panic as you cannot get the oxygen into your lungs. That's how she died. In agony, bleeding, choking. She was wearing a Domino's shirt, and also the wires from the taser were actually hanging from her body. There was also blood and duct tape in the car. So at that moment in time, the deputy sheriff knows it's Ashley, knows that the circumstances are clearly too coincidental to not actually have some kind of meaning. And this is confirmed to be Ashley not long after. It was actually Ashley's mother, Kimberly, who was contacted by the police and asked if Ashley had got any tattoos. At this point, she said, yeah, my daughter's got two stars on the back of each arm. She's also got a belly button tattoo. And that was enough to make it clear that that was indeed who they had found, who they had discovered. So now they've found Ashley's body. Understandably, the police have got a reason to execute a search warrant at Cobb's house. And wow, it is so incriminating. So a backpack's found in the back of the property. It's near a chicken coop. When they look inside that backpack, they found a really large knife, a neoprene mask. They find gloves, they find a taser, they find duct tape. They even find large industrial-sized zip ties. Apparently they were found out in the open, and those same exact zip ties had been found on Ashley's body. Now, no one needs any experience or qualifications in the criminal field to understand that that's a kill kit, pure and simple. No one has any of those items unless they have or are intending to kill somebody, simple as. And the very fact that they've gathered all of those things together is truly terrifying. There's got to be planning put into those kind of items. And it's harrowing to imagine that somebody has taken the time to actually think about the demise of another human being in this way. Particularly as what we're talking about is Ashley. Ashley is a young woman who loves her daughter. Note, that's why she's dead. She loves her daughter. She's not dead because she's an abuser. She's not dead because she's a child molester. She's not dead because she's done something absolutely harrowing that somebody knows about. She's dead because she loves her child. That's the only reason that Ashley has ended up zip-tied and dead, bloody, in the back of her own car. They also found camouflage clothing, face paint, a roll of duct tape, a pair of gloves with hardened knuckles, and also a flashlight with a red lens used to provide night vision. It is literally a specific kit that has been designed to ensure that the person who is going to be murdered is murdered effectively, simple as. Now, the police obviously then think about the call that was made to Domino's, and they are aware straight away that it must have been a fake call. It couldn't have been somebody actually ordering pizza. There's no coincidence that she's turned up and then found herself dead in this way. So they believe that the call was made by somebody luring Ashley to the secluded location. And what they know is it's a woman who made that call. So it's a woman who's brought her there, and then Cobb allegedly attacked her when she was attempting to deliver the pizza. Now, that business was closed, so it also feels like they've scoped out the area to make sure that no one's going to interfere with the murder itself. Bear in mind, they put the crime together in this way. They think that she arrived with the pizzas. At this point, she was hit in the head, tasered, then strangled with a 4-foot-long zip tie. At this point, they believe that Cobb bundled her into the back seat of her car and then drove to the location where she was discovered. Cobb is then charged with aggravated murder. They actually set his bond at $1.5 million, so he didn't have that money. He wasn't going to be getting out. So at the time of his arrest, no charges were actually set against his wife, Erica Stefanko, which one can understand to some degree. What they know at this moment in time is that he is likely the person who carried out the killing. And the evidence as to Erica Stefanko's role is at that point early on, not necessarily fully understood. But he's inside and she's not. We get to June 22nd, 2012. This is where Ashley's autopsy is performed, and they found that Ashley's cause of death was ruled as asphyxiation, and it was due to the zip tie ligatures encircling and compressing her neck. She'd also suffered from just so many other injuries to her scalp, her face, her body. She must have been absolutely petrified in those final moments. On July the 3rd, Ashley's family were at least given the opportunity to lay her to rest. She may have died in the most gruesome and heinous of ways, but at least her family were able to take her home, take her body home at least, and make sure that they had a place to go and visit her. I think often when a murder victim disappears and people understand that that person has come to a terrible end, but no body's been turned up, it's incredibly challenging psychologically for the family, because you don't have any sense of being able to feel that you have back the person of incalculable worth to you. Whereas in this case, at least they do have a place to visit. After the autopsy, Ashley's body was given back to her family, and on July the 3rd, she was laid to rest. That was actually also the last time that Ashley's family had contact with Grace, her daughter. Chad Cobb's mum, she was granted full custody of Grace. Now, at Cobb's arraignment, he was actually told that he was going to be facing the death penalty because the crime was so planned, premeditated, so utterly brutal, so futile as well when you consider why he killed her. So ludicrous. It was just over custody of a child that's going to grow up and who will choose and select the relationship that means most to them. All he needed to do was be a great dad, and Grace would have grown up loving and connecting with him and valuing him and raising him up as a mentor and a father and a protector. But instead, he's put her in a situation where he's going to be going to prison, and at the very beginning of the charges, potentially dying because of the death sentence. So with that death sentence potentially on the table, he made the wise decision, as far as any of us would be concerned, to plea. So in February 2013, he said that he was guilty of aggravated murder, kidnapping, aggravated robbery, felonious assault, retaliation, tampering with evidence, abuse of a corpse, possession of criminal tools and domestic violence. And he was basically sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole. But of course, that meant that even though he had a life without the possibility of parole in prison, he did have a life. And even though he's not going to be able to physically be free, he will still be able to see members of his family. He will still be able to have relationships with people who love him, something that he absolutely 100% denied his ex, Ashley. Now, he said that the reason that he decided to agree to that plea was all about considering his children, that he knew that he would be dead, he wouldn't be able to be part of their lives, it would be even more of a burden for them to have to carry, and he didn't want to do that. And also, he was really worried that if he didn't, he'd lose his parental rights, and that would mean that his family would have no custody rights. That would mean that potentially the kids could grow up in foster care and he genuinely didn't want that to happen. Also, down the line, he's going to completely change his story and he's going to say that he wasn't indeed responsible for Ashley's murder at all. Now, Ashley and Cobb's daughter at this point, as I said, were placed with his paternal grandparents, Cindy and Jay Cobb. Apparently, they were incredibly close to her. So her life and her experience will be a lovely one because she was cherished by these individuals and had a very close relationship with them before all of the acrimony, before all of the problems. She was always the centre of their world. And at least that means that for Ashley's daughter, she's in a place where she's understood the consistency and the compassion of these people, and she's got a really strong relationship with them. I also think it's really sad, though, for Ashley's family that they're probably not going to have any kind of relationship with Grace as she grows up, because they did nothing wrong, and I'm sure all parties would like to have a good relationship with her. Now, when it comes down to the daughter, in this case, Grace, understandably, she now has a mother, biologically, who's dead, and a father who's spending the rest of his life in prison, and she therefore needs some counselling because she's a child of murder. She's a child of the incarceration of her father for the rest of his life, and that is going to be enormously upsetting. Now, it's during these sessions some really interesting information comes out. She starts to talk about the fact that while she was living with her father and with Stefanko, she was being really horribly abused by Stefanko, not by her father. Cobb, as far as she is concerned, was the best parent she could have ever experienced. She adored him. She said he was wonderful to her. She said that he was always somebody who made her feel safe. And she didn't ever tell him that she was enduring this horrific abuse at the hands of Stefanko. So she hadn't described any of this to her father. One of the reasons, because she didn't want to affect the way that he might feel towards her, because she's constantly being told by Stefanko that he won't believe her. And the other thing is that she thinks, well, if I do tell him and he does believe me, and then he speaks to Stefanko about this, it's going to be even worse for me because she's going to be even more abusive. Apparently, Stefanko had hit her and she was abusive to her emotionally constantly. And in one instance, she literally had her on the floor with a hand covering her mouth and a knee on her chest, which would have been terrifying. And she only let her go when she nearly fainted. Also, she says that she was forced to eat dog feces. Now, bear in mind, Stefanko in court denies this. She said that it was a particular night when Grace was 4 years old and Grace was acting out. I mean, at 4 years old, I'm going to be honest with you, I don't see a lot of four-year-olds acting out at the dinner table. Usually, going to throw it out there, they're hungry. It's as simple as that. We'll sit down and happily eat the food. Unless you're a terrible cook, which Stefanko may well have been, with respect. So at 4 years old, apparently, she's acting out around the table, doesn't want to eat her food, and it's meatloaf. So Stefanko decides to tell her when this little girl is basically saying to Stefanko that the food is like dog poo, that it is indeed dog poo. I mean, I don't know about you. I'm imagining those difficult days and nights if you've got a child to feed and you're thinking to yourself, oh, this child, they're acting out. They're saying they don't like my food, even though they're four. I mean, honestly, is it just me? Is it just me who thinks at this point that somebody wants to go to Stefanko? Either your cooking is really bad, or maybe you're making this up completely and you're just trying to make it look better for yourself by saying the kid's the problem, not you. But basically, you know how it is. Four-year-olds, they're always complaining about the food. And apparently that's exactly what was happening. And this little girl saying it's like dog poo. So Stefanko goes, it is dog poo. And like I said, that's the most encouraging you'll ever get as a parent, isn't it? Yeah, it is dog poo. Eat it. You know, I had a problem with meatloaf. Just going to throw it out there. I had a problem with it looking like meatloaf. I said it looked like dog poo. I didn't want to eat it when I thought it was meatloaf. And now they're saying it is in fact dog feces. Well, you can take that dog feces and you can shove it somewhere alternative to my mouth. Anyway, this is what she says she's doing. She's annoyed with the kid. So she decides to lie to the child and say that the meatloaf is indeed dog poo. And then basically forces her to eat the dog poo. And she alleges in court, Stefanko, that at this point, understandably, she gets upset because she wasn't feeding her dog poo, but she thought it was dog poo. And as a four-year-old child, was probably, I don't know, just a bit traumatised by the idea. Also, if she was traumatised as she was eating what she thought was dog poo, which was meatloaf, and was actually psychologically believing it was indeed dog poo, it must have tasted really bad, because usually you'd put it in your mouth and think, no, it's not dog poo at all. I mean, it's meatloaf and maybe I don't like it, but at the end of the day, it's way better than I thought. But no, that's not what happened. And also, I believe that this is just all fabrication. I think Stefanko did feed this little girl dog poo, because what really happened, according to the little girl at the time, who is giving evidence in court down the line, she says that she was told by her stepmother that she put dog poo in blueberry yogurt and that she forced her to eat it. In fact, Grace, the daughter, said, I knew what it was. She was screaming and yelling, and I didn't have an option but to eat it. So basically, she knew because of the taste. Now, Stefanko in court denies this again and says, what I did was I put antibiotics in the blueberry yogurt, and she knew that there was something foreign in the blueberry yogurt, got hysterical because she didn't like the taste of it, because we didn't realise how awful it tasted. Now, again, to anybody who's ever had a child in the history of children, who's ever been a child and been given antibiotics, we all know they don't taste amazing in those horrible fruit flavoured things that they put it in. You know, thick, gloggy medicine a lot of the time, but it's not terrible. And if you mix it in with blueberry yogurt, it's really going to be better than just having it cold as it is. So the idea that she could misjudge it as dog poo versus antibiotics is ludicrous. This is Stefanko minimising. And I think that's one thing that Stefanko has in oodles, is the ability to try to minimise her role. One of the reasons why Grace, the daughter in this, feels that Stefanko was so horrible to her was that she was jealous of the close relationship that she had with her father. So she would hug her dad when he got home from work. She'd kiss her dad when he got home from work, because that's what kids do. That's what happens when you have a loving relationship with your papa. You want to be around them. Daddies and daughters are often very close. And apparently the two of them would go off for breakfast on a Saturday morning. And Stefanko hated this. And in court, Stefanko does admit that she didn't like the relationship between Grace and her father because he was so close to her. And she says that Grace got more attention, that she was the favourite one, that they did things individually with one another. And it takes your breath away, because you're sitting there thinking, you're a grown ass woman. So what? They've got a close relationship. This is something that should be risen up. This is something that should be celebrated. If a man can treat his daughter beautifully, it says something about who he is. And it also says something about what that child will expect. You bring a girl up believing that she is so important, believing that she deserves to be treated with respect. She's going to play that out in her future relationships. We all want that for our girls in this world. And that's all that's happening. And also, we have to remember that for a long period of time, Grace was with him by herself. There was a period of time where Stefanko wasn't in the picture and where he was bringing up his little girl. So of course, there's going to be a special bond between them, because it was a sanctuary for both of them for a period of time. It was just he and her. But Stefanko resents this massively. And she also threatened her. She threatened Grace that she would cause problems in their relationship if she dared to tell him. And she just believed that this would ultimately mean that she'd get more and more angry and her life would be more and more problematic. Now, Chad Cobb genuinely didn't learn about the abuse until his daughter started to talk about it in those counselling sessions. So that must have been very upsetting for him, because he must have felt like the woman that he believed he could trust in their relationship was actually deceiving him on a grotesque level. And bear in mind, the main motivation of Cobb seems to be in this crime, the feelings that he has towards his daughter, the protection he feels towards his daughter. It's misplaced and it's wrong what he does. But the psychology and emotional experience here is what we're talking about regarding his link with his daughter. So you can only begin to imagine how he would feel about a woman he's living with, who he's got kids with, actually abusing this child that he is so passionately protective over. That would drive him to a very desperate place. So this girl is being brought up in an environment where her dad is wonderful with her, where her stepmom literally fits the evil stepmother picture from Disney movies, and where this girl's silence is to do with the fear that she feels. But equally, if she had spoken out, we can just imagine the ramifications that would have happened in that experience, because he would have been so angry with Stefanko that she was harming their child, or the child that he had that ultimately became hers because of their relationship. So she's a step parent, and yet she's harming this little girl. And he is only finding this out way down the line. So bear in mind, he's serving life without parole. How is it going to start impacting on him when he starts to see that the woman he was with is nothing like the woman he believed he was with? Now, from the origin of this crime, from the very inception of what occurs, the police know that Cobb was not acting alone. It's as simple as that. There is absolutely an accomplice to Ashley's killing. First of all, just the phone call. It was a female voice who made the call to the fake pizza order. It's as simple as that. So there's a woman involved. Also, the police aren't going to need to look too far, are they? There was a woman present with Cobb the night that Ashley was clearly kidnapped and murdered. So they're looking directly in Stefanko's direction, but figuring out the information that's required to build a case against her is going to be pretty difficult. Now, when they look for the phone number that was used to make that fake pizza call, they realise it was from a prepaid cell phone. Now, at Cobb's home, the police had actually found a receipt for 2 15-minute air cards. Now, the police were able to get surveillance footage from Walmart, which showed Chad Cobb and Erica Stefanko and their kids all in the Walmart store, at which point Chad Cobb buys the cards, and then those minutes were added to the phone on June the 20th. Now, this is very incriminating because she is present. She is there. So ultimately, she is certainly part of the plan. Now, they suspect, of course, that she's the person who's made the call, but she's also likely the person who has been pumping Cobb with the idea of going ahead and killing Ashley. And ultimately, even if that's not the reality, she's certainly been complicit. She's certainly somebody who is involved in the killing. Now, at first, I would say Cobb is very loyal. So he doesn't speak to investigators about Stefanko's participation in the murder. He just carries on accepting the charges, says that he's guilty, but he doesn't give any information over that incriminates her. However, this does change in December 2017, at which point he provides a statement to a detective regarding her involvement. Now, bear in mind, things have changed a little bit for Cobb. Things have become, I would say, a little bit more, as my kids would say, salty for Cobb, because Cobb's wife, Erica Stefanko, at this point, has cheated on him with his best friend. I mean, just gonna throw it out there. That's certainly gonna be something that devastates Cobb. I mean, if it isn't challenging enough that she's just got away and is walking the streets free, which would be upsetting for anybody if they've been part of something. Even if you were loyal to them, it's still going to grate on you a little bit over time. But if that said person has now cheated on you with your best friend, even going so far as to marry that best friend, and then go further to have a daughter with that best friend, and then, oh, I don't know, just stops visiting you in prison. So the disloyalty is so enormous. Imagine all of those wounds. You know, she's free, wound one. She's going out with your best friend, wound two. She has a kid and marries your best friend, wound three, and you're still sat in the cell and you're ruminating on the fact that she's got all of that and you've got nothing. And like I said, she doesn't even bother to come and see you anymore. She doesn't even bother to come and visit you, to give you a little bit of respite, no. And suddenly you'd realise that the person you believed she was just didn't exist. And add to that the fact that you found out that she's been abusive to the daughter that you actually killed for. I mean, it's going to be a cooking pot of resentment without a doubt. Now, even though all of this is bubbling to the surface, the police genuinely hadn't had enough evidence to arrest Stefanko for being involved. And I would say it really bothered them. In fact, the New Franklin police didn't give up at all, especially a guy called Detective Michael Hitchens. He genuinely didn't want to let this go. He knew that Erica Stefanko was walking the streets free and it was completely unfair. And after 4 years in prison, Chad Cobb suddenly begins to talk. And that, we can all understand why. You know, he knows that Erika Stavanko's got a divorce from him. We know she's had a baby with his best mate. He stopped bringing the children as well to visit him. So not just the visits have ended as far as her coming, she's stopped the children coming. Can you imagine how he's going to be feeling? The very thing that he is most passionate about, his children. And don't get me wrong, there is no excuse for his actions. What he's done, bringing about the demise and the murder of some innocent woman just because he's jealous of the relationship she potentially has with their dead daughter, that's never going to be enough to go ahead and do what we've talked about in this case today. But what I'm saying is, imagine seeing that the person who knows the passion you have for your children is now preventing you from having any relationship with them. So, I don't know, Chad Cobb sat in his cell one day and he's thinking, you know, feels a little bit unfair, these slings and arrows of outrageous fortune where I just seem to be sitting in a cell rotting away for the rest of my natural life, not even having contact with my kids, my best mates, shacked up with my ex, got a pregnant, had a baby, and I'm really starting to think about how unfair this feels. What could I do? Well, I could sit here and I could accept my fate. I could be loyal and carry on down this road where only I suffer. I could accept that she has a right to move on. After all, I'm going to be in here for the rest of my natural life and she needs to continue with her future. I could just accept that, or I could ruin her. A feeling that the idea of ruining her is probably a far better plan. Ruin her. Has somebody got any paper? I want to ruin somebody. Got a pen too? Thanks. No, that's a shank. I think it's just a homemade shank. Yeah, just a biro. That'd be great. Thank you. Could you take the razor blade off the end of it? Sorry, anyway, me going on to some fantasy there about how it is in prison. They do that though. They do that with toothbrush and razor blades. I've got good advice and knowledge on this, and I've actually covered some injuries that happen to prisoners using such implements. But he doesn't do that. He gets a pen and a piece of paper, and he writes to Detective Hitchens, who, of course, is desperate to bring Erika Stavanko to justice, so you can imagine when the letter drops into his lap. And wow, this letter is big. Chad Cobb says it was Erika Stefanko who called and ordered the pizza. He said that Erika Stefanko used the name Jen in the call and said that she was the mastermind behind all of it, that she'd driven him to the location that night in the Lincoln Navigator, that she was the person who literally premeditated and put into plan the attack on Ashley. And you can just imagine, can't you, the blood rushing through Detective Hitchens' veins when he realises he's got this information. But it isn't a smoking gun, because bear in mind, what would happen in this case is the defence would say, listen, this is ludicrous. You've got this guy who's jealous. His best friend has got his ex-wife pregnant. She's living her life, this innocent, free woman who deserves a new chance to have a life without this kind of predatory killer around her. And now he's jealous of that and angry, so he's making this stuff up. That's the way that they'd go and play this. So it's not going to be exactly enough to bring her down. But in 2018, Cindy Cobb, that's Chad's mother, she gives police a recording of a conversation that took place between her and Stefanko in 2014. Hell hath no fury like a woman scorned. That's the way the saying goes. But I would add to that, hell hath no fury like a mother betrayed. Seriously, if you're a mother and you see your child in a situation that you don't necessarily believe is fully their responsibility, and you can do anything to actually change that reality, even if it's just be on a reputational level where people understand what happened more, you are going to do that. You are literally going to move hell and high water to do so. Now, in this audio that she has covertly recorded, Stefanko literally implicates herself in the murder, and there is nothing more beautiful than a perpetrator's own words condemning them. So in January 2018, Chad Cobb's mum hands the police this. She gives them the recording device, and these recordings are between her and Stefanko. This is just taken 2 years after Ashley was killed. And on that recording, Cindy and Erika Stefanko are discussing the murder. And Stefanka can literally be heard admitting to setting Ashley up, to making the pizza delivery phone call. And Stefanko even admitted that Chad had never forced her to do it. And there is also, tellingly, a moment in the trial where Stefanko herself is asked whether she was upset that Ashley Biggs was dead, and she indicated that she wasn't at all, because, I don't know, this woman's got not even a shred of remorse, guilt, or even a soul. There's not even a shred. Is there a soul there? Erica Stefanko, is there a soul there? Sorry? Is there a soul there? Well, I'm the soul. You don't sound very big. No, some humans don't really have very big souls. How big are you? Imagine a postage stamp and then divide it into a million. That's the kind of size I am. I don't think that her soul probably has that voice, but you know where I'm going with it, guys. So on November the 19th, 2019, I imagine to her surprise, Stefanko's arrested. At this point, she's charged with aggravated murder, kidnapping, and aggravated robbery. Now, she'd initially been indicted on more charges, including gross abuse of a corpse, tampering with evidence, and possessing criminal tools. But they had basically been dismissed, and the reason for that was due to the statutes of limitations. That's the maximum time after a crime was committed that legal action can be taken. And then the date was set for the trial to happen, which is in June 2020. Of course, we all know what happened, though, in 2020, don't we? Unless we were very fortunate and living, I don't know, under a rock with no communication or humans around them. But for the rest of all mere mortals, we all know that a state of emergency was announced as a result of COVID-19. So because of this, it was decided that the trial would go ahead either in person, remotely by video conference, or indeed as a hybrid of the two. So we get to October 2020. At this point, it was decided that due to the COVID-19 restrictions, basically Cobb wouldn't be transported from prison for the trial. Now, that's an issue because, you know, there's a lot of stuff that happens when you are confronted by somebody face to face, the way they look, the way they act, the way they sound. And the fact that Cobb isn't going to be present probably changes the way that the trial would feel. And Stefanko objected to Cobb actually being able to testify remotely. They said, I want him to be here. I want him to have to give testimony in person. Both the prosecution and the defence actually objected to the trial going ahead in this manner. So it wasn't as if either party, defence or prosecution, were happy with the way it was going to go ahead. But regardless of that, they were like, hey, everyone's saying this shouldn't happen. This shouldn't happen. The prosecution's saying it shouldn't happen. The defence is saying it shouldn't happen. I'm just going to throw it out there. If the prosecution's saying it shouldn't happen like this, it's probably because they really think that it's bad it should happen, because if it was going to be working for them, they'd be saying, let's do it remotely. And if the defence is saying the same, it kind of suggests we should probably listen to them. And they were like, you know what, we thought we would. And then we went, no, we're going to ignore you completely. So the trial begins, despite these reservations, on November the 16th, 2020. Now, during Chad Cobb's testimony, and it is really frustrating to watch, so it took place on a video call. And the reason it's frustrating is because the sound is awful and things break down and you can't really make things out and you can't see his facial expressions. All of these things happen. But nonetheless, they're taking this as a scenario where he can go ahead and do it in spite of all these limitations. He talks about the relationship he had with Ashley. He said that she left both him and their daughter a couple of months after she had been born, and that the communication from Ashley was very sporadic after she left in 2005. And I would say that whilst on one level that certainly seems true to an extent, on another, he didn't make it easy at all. So he moves, he changes his number. Even Stefanko, who was clearly defending herself at court, does come down very harsh on the way he was around his treatment of Ashley. And I also appreciate that she's doing that because she doesn't have any positive thoughts about the man who's brought her into court and possibly sent her to prison for the rest of her life. I understand why she's saying those things, but I think it probably makes sense that he wasn't the nicest person when it came down to being around Ashley and the contact that she wanted with her daughter. But certainly Ashley did have issues in contact with her daughter. Part of that is her fault and part of that is undoubtedly Chad Cobb's fault. So what he suggests is between 2005, 2009, there really wasn't any contact between the mother and the daughter. but it all changed in October 2011. Now, bear in mind, she's in a different place now. She's been in the army and she's looking for a relationship with her daughter. So on the 5th of October 2011, Ashley and her girlfriend Brittany, they picked up her daughter from school and then took her out of school by taking out a civil protection order, which Chad Codd had no idea over. So suddenly his daughter's been taken, yes, by her biological mother, but without his knowledge, certainly without him understanding why. And this is basically the start of that very contentious custody battle, which went through the courts. And I think that anybody as a parent could understand the horror you would feel if you turn up to pick your child up from school and she's been taken by, yes, another biological parent, but without your knowledge, without your agreement, and suddenly you don't feel that you know what's happening next, and you're fearful and afraid and concerned and angry. Chad Codd would feel all those feelings, and we can validate and accept them. It's just that clearly, as opposed to working this through the courts, he decides at some point to take matters into his own hands. And bear in mind, even though he's telling this information in court, this is only ever going to be a one-way story. He is able to say what he's saying because Ashley is dead and she can't come back and deny what's happening. We can't just take his word as the truth. Now, when Cobb was questioned on the night of the fateful murder, he said that Stefanka had actually driven him and the kids past Domino's because they wanted to check out that Ashley's car was outside it. Then they put the plan into motion. They'd driven to the car park of the business on West Turkeyfoot Lake Road. And this is obviously where Ashley had been killed. Now, apparently, after the couple had gotten out of the car, kids stayed inside, thank God, at least they didn't have to witness something so terrible. Stefanko had then called Domino's. She'd ordered the pizza using a fake name. Cobb actually said that initially he hadn't even been aware she was going to do this. She then drove away with the kids and she left him at the car park. He was then asked, okay, you didn't know that she was going to do that, but you didn't have to wait. You didn't have to stay at that business place waiting for Ashley. You could just have left of your own volition. Why on earth did you decide to stay? And he said, well, you know what? I wasn't necessarily waiting for her, but I was kind of stuck there because my partner had driven off. Now again, let's just dissect that. So you're telling me that you didn't actually intend to murder Ashley? No, I was just thinking, you know, my partner has just driven off and left me here after making a phone call to order a pizza that neither of us want to eat. That does ultimately sound like you're waiting for Ashley, specifically when you consider the fact that you've ordered a pizza now that neither of you want to eat. It does, but I'm just saying that I was just hanging around. I was just hanging around in the dead of night at a closed business park with my ex coming to deliver a pizza that neither myself nor my ex now, who's, by the way, married to my best friend, wanted to eat. I'm not bitter at all. Anyway, getting back to the story and not concentrating on the fact that she's had a baby with my ex-best friend now, who I used to really like because he was my best friend. But I'm not bitter at all. I'm saying I was just hanging around in the dark with a pizza order being delivered by my ex, maybe with a kill kit. Sorry? I might have had a kill kit. You had a kill kit. You were waiting around for a pizza that you didn't want and you just hung around thinking what? Well, I was just thinking whether she'd got more than four toppings, if I'm really honest. I mean, it makes no sense, doesn't it? Of course he was waiting to kill her. Of course he was waiting to kill her. Because when Ashley arrives and clearly, when she sees her ex, who obviously has a kill kit with him, he said that she got worked up and wasn't happy to sleep. No, she wouldn't have got worked up, Cobb. She'd have been absolutely petrified. He's in the dark. He's made a false call to get a pizza delivered. He's waiting in the dark. He's got something with him. She's not going to be worked up. She is definitely not going to be happy to see him, but she's going to be petrified. Now, he was actually asked, is it fair to say that Ashley did not leave the parking lot alive that night? He said, yes, sir, that is accurate. But none of us need that responded to. It's obvious that he killed her. I do feel, even though I have some sympathy and empathy for his position, i.e. he's taking all the blame, I do feel genuinely when I've watched the court case that he is putting a lot on Stefanko here. I think that she's definitely a co-conspirator. But at the end of the day, she allegedly didn't actually get involved with the killing itself. But again, we can only hear from one side, and this is what he says. He says that basically she was the one who's responsible for organising it. She's the one who forced him to do it, and that's why Ashley ended up dead. And like I said, the most bizarre suggestion that he makes is that he was just waiting there and that's why he killed her. Not, well, I could just have walked away. He didn't have to murder her. It's bizarre that he's even trying to throw that in as if that minimises and mitigates what he did. Now, after he's killed Ashley, he calls Stefanko. She comes back to the scene with the children. Yeah. She comes back with the kids. He then puts Ashley's body in the back seat of Ashley's car. Apparently it wasn't easy because Ashley was quite a muscular woman. He said that she was really heavy. He then drove her to the cornfield, and that's where she was ultimately discovered, and Stefanko followed behind him. He then abandons Ashley's car with her body inside. He then got in the passenger seat of the car with Stefanko. So that puts her at every scene within this crime. Then went on to say they went home. He showered because he was literally covered in blood. Then they both went back to the scene of the crime because they wanted to clean it up because they don't want people to realise that she's been murdered there. But the reason they didn't do that is because they end up driving past without stopping because the police were there. Yes, because the manager, who's an amazing manager of that Domino's, called the police because he had gone to that place where the delivery had occurred and found that there was blood everywhere. So they kind of get tripped up. They don't get to do what they'd intended to do. And so that's at the point that they drive to Cobb's grandparents. And this is, of course, where Cobb and Stefanko were taken into custody. Now, I've watched hours of the testimony of Cobb. And like I said, if any of you want to do that, it's worth it, but you will be frustrated. That conducting the interview over the video, it just doesn't work well at all. He couldn't hear the judge half the time when she spoke. It kept freezing. They kept trying to share images over the computer, and lots of the time that didn't even work. For example, Cobb could only see a black screen regularly when they're meant to be showing him evidence or things that he has to confirm. Also, something that I really took umbrage to was he has to wear a mask. Now, why he had to wear a mask is bizarre. At the end of the day, I appreciate there'll have been a prison officer with him or security staff with him, but it's ridiculous to me that he could not remove that mask because it meant that people struggled to hear what he was saying. You know, he wasn't in the courtroom, no one was in his immediate vicinity. There's no reason for him not to have had his mask off so people could see his facial cues and also make sense of the words that he's saying. It's an extra challenge to piece together what somebody's saying when you can't see their mouth movements. So I would say it's a bit of a nightmare, the whole court case. We get to November the 25th, 2020, and you won't be surprised to hear that Stefanko was found guilty of aggravated murder and murder. She wasn't found guilty of kidnapping and aggravated robbery. She was found to have caused Ashley's death purposely and with prior calculation and design. She was later sentenced to life in prison, but she would be offered the possibility of parole after 30 years. She then is understandably unhappy with this. She doesn't want it to be the case that she's going to go down for all this time. So the defence argued for a mistrial. Now, that's actually denied, but then she appeals it and it was found that there were reasonable grounds for the appeal. So the reason that there are apparently reasonable grounds is that she argued that her right to a fair trial, due process of law, and right to confront witnesses had been violated due to the COVID-19 restrictions. So she was successful in that. To me, I almost think that there was no point in her doing that because there are technical issues in the way I've described, I don't think that in any way removes the guilt that they're dealing with regarding the conviction. I think it was strong. The prosecution's case was very strong. And yeah, there were these technical issues, but is it going to eventuate in a different result? That really wouldn't make sense because it's such a powerful case that clearly indicates that she was involved in the construction of this murder. Now, in December 2022, interestingly, Cobb, he filed a motion to withdraw his guilty plea. So he said, basically, it was a threat of losing parental rights if he didn't plead that made him go guilty. He said that his counsel had therefore encouraged him to plead. Now, in January 2024, we've got Stefanko's retrial. The prosecution at this point, they allege, as they had prior to this, that she helped Cobb to kill Ashley. They said, it's clear he didn't do it alone. That's why we're here. She played her part. Stefanko, she testified. Now, she hadn't testified in her original trial. She claimed that as far as she was concerned, she'd made the call to Domino's to order the pizza. She didn't know that Cobb was going to kill Ashley and that she hadn't participated in the murder. She said that she believed that Cobb was just planning to plant meth in Ashley's car because he wanted to hurt the case in their ongoing custody battle at the time. Can we just analyse that for a minute? So she calls for a pizza. This is her mindset. So, yeah, I just made the call. Why did you make the call? Well, I just made the call because I thought I'll get her to this place where she sees her ex and he just, you know, has a chat with her whilst planting meth in her car. And how is he going to do that? He's just going to casually wander over. I just need a chat with you, Ashley. And she's going to be like, oh, okay. Can you just wind your window down? Yeah, of course I can. Not the front one or the back one. Why do you want me to wind the back window down? I just want to leisurely lean in. Just going to, what are you doing up in my seat? Nothing. I'm doing nothing. I mean, how would that work? Seriously. Just play that out in your head. But this is the story that she's concocted. No, she's had one trial before, so she knows where they're going with this. So she's like, okay, maybe I just need to come up with this idea that he was going to plant crystal meth in the car and this will hurt the custody case. Now, they had, with respect, previously as a couple, planted marijuana in Ashley's girlfriend's car for exactly the same reason. Hadn't actually had the intended effect, but they'd done it. That, and it's a crime itself, planting something on another individual. Now, her defense argued that it was actually more logical to go from marijuana to meth rather than marijuana to murder. But that would make sense if you weren't a massively murderous couple, which these two are. We're talking about somebody who wanted to make a problem disappear. And that problem would disappear as Ashley was murdered. Now, as well as Stefanko testifying in this retrial, Cobb also testified in person in this retrial. He wouldn't admit that he actually killed Ashley, but his testimony was referred to as damning when it came down to establishing her involvement. And he also went on to say that the reason he was testifying against Stefanko wasn't just because she'd married his best friend. But I think none of us believe that. I mean, I don't want to assume anything. You can't, can you? I'm not these people. But, you know, while she was still bringing the kids to visit him, while she was still being relatively loyal to him, you know, he remained quiet. He didn't say anything. But the minute she's got married and had a baby with his ex-best mate, he's a bit pissed off, isn't he? And that probably is what made him decide to break that loyalty. And with respect, who cares what the reason is? She deserves everything that's coming. Also in court on this occasion, Ashley and Chad's daughter testified. She actually said that she heard Stefanko place the Domino's pizza order using an alias. And she said that whilst it was terrifying, because bear in mind, she was a teenager by the time this retrial is occurring against Stefanko. So she has got a big axe to grind. She had a horrible experience growing for a period of time with this woman as her stepmother. And she said that the way that she got herself psychologically prepared to testify was basically binge watching the courtroom drama Bull. And she did a really good job. Apparently before the trial, she was coming and going and toing and froing about whether she'd take the stand. And to help her come to terms with the decision and to understand the process, the court actually appointed her an attorney from the Ohio Crime Victim Justice Center, which is a Powell, Ohio-based agency that assists crime victims. So at this point, she felt that she was confident enough to go ahead, and she decided that she wanted to testify in person, which is astonishingly courageous. She wanted to do that rather than by video. She felt that by giving evidence in person, it would have more of an impact. So she's a real smart cookie. She can understand that actually for the jury to see her and to watch the impact and to look at how she portrays herself, that is something that can certainly make a huge impact and in effect make a difference to the verdict. Apparently she was really nervous when she took the witness stand, but she found it easier than she had initially anticipated. She said that she didn't look at Stefanko. Instead, she focused on Assistant Prosecutor Brian LaPrinza, who was the person trying the case with Felicia Easter. The teen said that at one point she did lock eyes with Stefanko and she did see that she'd been crying, which I suppose was something that would be challenging to see, but also a celebration because it means that she's doing her job giving this truthful evidence. Aside from noting that she overheard the fake pizza delivery phone call being made by Stefanko, she also said that she recalled it was absolutely pitch black outside. She then recalled sleeping in the car and then waking up the next morning at her great-grandparents' house. So fortunately, she doesn't have any of the gruesome details stored in her memory and she wasn't present at the killing. But nonetheless, she can see how the timeline played out. Also, Cobb's mother Cindy testified, bear in mind what I talked about earlier on, the audio recording, that strongly implicated Stefanko in the murder. She could literally be heard saying, if everything was told as it happened, we would both be in prison now. Every time I hear a siren, I think they're coming for me. It took two of us. I carried out my part. I did exactly what he told me to do. So she's still, even though she's saying she was a part of the killing and the planning and the premeditation, she's basically saying that she was the puppet and he was the puppet master. But it's enough for any jury to hear that and know that she was 100% involved, if not the director, certainly somebody who was a willing participant. She also said that Cobb made a comment about saving Ashley's skull as a trophy. She also said, do I feel bad about what happened to her? No, I really don't. Could you be any more of a brutal, cold-blooded individual? No, you really don't. This woman died in the most gruesome and terrifying of manners, and all she wanted to do was to love her child. That's all she's guilty of. And yet even when she has been murdered, it turns out Stefanko doesn't care at all. Mary Brinkman, that was somebody who knew Cobb and Stefanko, she said that 2 weeks after the murder, Stefanko had told her that she dropped Cobb in an area where they both knew Ashley was going to be. And she then had implied to her that she knew exactly who made the phone call for the pizza order. Also, that same witness said that Stefanko had defecated on Ashley's grave for, quote, all the shit she put us through. Which, if true, is a horrific indictment of the character of Stefanko. Now, don't get me wrong, Mary hadn't come forward with that information until 7 years after the conversation had taken place. Also, the defence put forward the fact that Mary was very close to Cobb and had actually visited the prison to see him. But it would be an unusual thing to make up. And let's be honest, there's far more incriminating information about Stefanko's role, from her own words to the fact that Cobb has listed exactly what played out in the crime. So Mary adding that information, it's not really going to make that much of a difference. But it just powerfully suggests there is a fracture within the kind of personality and character that we're dealing with when we're talking about somebody like Stefanko. Because if you can take a shit on somebody's grave because they loved their child and wanted a relationship with them, that says something really quite grotesque about who you are. Now, the medical examiner during this case talked about Ashley's injuries. They said that she'd been beaten up, she'd been strangled, she'd possibly been tasered. They showed the autopsy photographs to the court. Actually, Ashley's mother, Kim, she fainted when she saw those, literally fainted. Now, on January the 31st, 2024, again, you'll be unsurprised to hear that Stefanko was found guilty once again. It was obvious from the get-go that was going to happen. It almost feels like it was just this cruel opportunity once again to put Ashley's family through the trauma of another trial, because it was a technicality that led to the retrial, not because there was a weight of evidence that suggested that Stefanko wasn't indeed guilty. Prosecutor Brian Laprinzi said that Stefanko was a master manipulator. He also asked that she be given life without parole. He said it was the first time in his career he'd actually requested this for an accomplice in a murder case. Kimberly, Ashley's mother, who was obviously sickened by what she had to sit through in the trial and sickened by what she had to see. And remember, she'll have had those images burnt into her conscience until the last breath that she takes and she's reunited with her daughter. So for her, the pain and the burden of carrying those images is horrific. But she said that at least now her daughter can finally sleep. And Ashley's obituary reads, she was handed into the arms of her mother as one of God's kindest and gentlest children, full of smiles and laughter, kindness and joy to everyone who knew her, a smile that was as big as the world. And a friend actually said that there was literally not a mean bone in Ashley's body. In fact, they described her as one of a million, saying, if you met her once, you would never forget her. And prosecutor Brian Loprinzi said that Stefanka was a master manipulator. He'd actually asked for her to be given life without parole, which he said was the first time in his entire career that he had requested this from an accomplice in a murder case. She did get life in prison, but she will get the opportunity for parole potentially after 30 years. But as we know, just because you get parole opportunities doesn't mean that they will agree them. It could be that she does spend the rest of her natural life in prison. Now, whilst we've concentrated a great deal on the perpetrators in this case, we can't forget that Ashley's left a family behind and it's been devastating for them. Kimberly, Ashley's mother, said that at least now with this result, her daughter can finally sleep. And Ashley's obituary reads, she was handed into the arms of her mother as one of God's kindest and gentlest children, full of smiles and laughter, kindness and joy to everyone who knew her. A smile that was as big as the world. And a friend said that Ashley was one of those people who literally didn't have a mean bone in her body. They described her as one in a million. They said, if you met her once, you'd never forget her. And all of these people are the victims in this crime too. And what a senseless crime it is. And I really feel for Grace. I feel for their daughter. She ended up with no parents, really. This is after having two parents fighting for her. That's the ridiculous thing. Two parents who wanted her so desperately, and yet she ends up with neither. It just feels so grotesque, so destructive, and equally so unnecessary. And what I will know about Grace, Cobb's daughter, is that she actually thinks that her father deserves to spend time in prison, yes, but she also says that she hopes that he'll be released at some point. And apparently the two have remained in really close contact through letters, phone calls, and actually before the pandemic, she was visiting. She is quoted as saying, I don't have any negativity towards him. And she said that she plans to continue to visit him in the future. She hopes to go on to college and to also become a veterinarian. So she is loved, she is safe, she is cared for by her family. And whilst her life has had so much tragedy within it, hopefully the future is bright. And she is going to be afforded the opportunity to go and achieve her dreams. And even though I think a lot of us will struggle to connect with her feeling that she still has all these good feelings for her father, none of us were in that relationship. She didn't really have a close relationship with Ashley, not because Ashley didn't want one, just it hadn't had time to forge and be found. So therefore the alliance that she has is indeed with the father who loved her and who protected her and that made her feel safe. And even though what he did is reprehensible and inexcusable, we can separate the killer from the father as far as she is concerned. And the father, as far as she is concerned, was a very good one. I'd love to know your thoughts on this. Do you connect with Grace? Do you agree that that relationship with her father is one that she should continually cover and connect with and really respect in spite of what happened? Do you feel that maybe in time it will change and she'll realise that actually what he did was truly terrible? Do you feel that we're talking about Cobb as the mass manipulator? Or do you agree with the prosecution that the real killer in this case, the real individual who was responsible for what happened, was indeed Stefanko, somebody who was highly abusive to Grace and certainly seems to be a lot more of a predator than we may initially have anticipated. That's it for Bang to Rights today. Join me for the next episode. See you then. Be safe.